When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
あ、ここいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ？どこにいるのかな？見えない。
あ、こんな
ところ
だ。あ、
I miss you. What's good, Internet? It is Monday, February 25th, 2019, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio episode 222. That definitely has a significance in like numerology or something, but I don't know it. Coming to you from a jerry-rigged recording setup across three locations.
Yes.
I am your host, Natalie Watson, and joining me today, to my left, is Danielle Rianda.
I'm always to your left.
You are always to my left.
It's
pretty
so
much.
Great.
I love it.
It's a good time.
Patrick Klepek virtually in front of me.
I'm here.
Hello. And Rob also virtually coming to me from the computer.
The wind might knock out my internet connection at any moment. So if suddenly you just hear dead air, or if you hear like breaking glass and then like a scream and dead air, don't worry about it.
Okay.
I'll probably be back later today.
It's just the thing.
The wind today is bad, y'all. I almost was blown away. Luckily, right now we are in basically a bunker.
Yes.
So Waypoint NY is protected. But I worry for our friends over at Waypoint Chicago and Waypoint Boston.
Well, you have Waypoint Chicago's wind. Like, we had this windstorm come through yesterday.
Thanks for sending it.
You're welcome. It's terrible.
Yeah.
At least it's not garbage day, because the previous windstorm that so we had one 2 years ago. I was telling Rob about this before we recorded, where it's like legit kind of dangerous, like you know, it'll tear down trees and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I hadn't experienced a windstorm in a long time. Certainly not owning a house, where it's like you're worried about things differently than when landlords and other people are supposed to take care of things like that. So anyway, I'm up getting coffee in my kitchen, and I look onto my patio, and I notice my grill just moving from left to right on the patio, because the wind was just moving the grill.
That's alarming.
All over the place. I had never
put the
brakes on the wheels, because it's heavy as shit. Like,
yeah.
I tried, you know, you got to put some effort to move that thing. Like, I don't
Those
need to put
heavy.
The brakes on. Like, no, apparently you do. And then when I walked my dog yesterday, or attempted to before, my dog said, what are we doing out here? Like, I can just, you know, I can just shit in the corner, right? And
I'm like, you know,
right,
I can just shit on the rug. Right, buddy?
No, she's got a spot. She has we have a thing that's put out. She knows that's where she goes if the weather's bad outside, and we got to try and contain it. So
we
have that
dog.
Down.
That's a good dog.
But I got half a block down and noticed, like, a bunch of the siding of one of the houses had just been ripped off.
Oh, good.
By the wind and was just dangling. That's... in a way that was like, those look like, those are sheets of metal. I don't want to have my face cut off, so I'm going to turn around.
Yeah.
My dog's going to shit in the house is what's going to happen here.
Yep.
You know what's bad about New York is every day is trash day, so...
Everything is trash.
Everything
yes.
is trash. My Lyft driver on the way to work this morning was like, you know, you got to see a silver lining in this wind. All the trash is, you know, we have so much trash around here, it's just going to get blown. And I was like, blown to where? It's just going to stay here. And he was like, yeah, but, you know, it'll get blown away. And I was like, okay, I'll ride with you for this one. But
blown to where? That's the thing. Is it going to get blown to sea?
I hope not. I hope the Hudson River's okay.
You know?
I'm not sure.
It's almost certainly not.
It's probably not.
A perfect parable, though, of our relationship to our natural world, right? Like, this wind just whipping trash somewhere sure is good for the world.
Yeah, must be.
Not my problem.
Not my problem anymore. It's not on my doorstep.
Apparently Sarah David, whose birthday it is today, happy birthday, Sarah David of Broadly, was on the phone. She was FaceTiming her grandmother for her birthday, and the wind whipped an old pizza box into her, slapping into her, and her grandmother was, like, freaking out, like, go inside! And she was like, 30's treating me great. This is going well.
Hell yeah.
I was really hoping, like, just an old pizza was going to be the end of that story. Like, just an old pizza just, like, whips her into the
pizza
face.
Box just, is a disappointment.
Yeah, just fucking
slapped by pizza in
that
the face.
Honestly would have been, I think, a little bit more dignifying, less. I think more. Because then it's like, you know.
You had a classic New York moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
I'm pretty sure that was only one of New the York, deaths baby. In Russian Doll was, you know, death by slice of pizza. But.
Sounds right.
We should talk about games. And I say not video games, because today we're starting off with a board game.
Oh, my God.
From our own resident board game connoisseur, Rob Zachney. Tell me about Empire of the Sun, please.
Empire of the Sun is a World War II Pacific Theater war game that I am getting increasingly into. And it is one of the most, like, clever war game designs I've maybe ever seen.
Did you use your counter cutter thingy for it?
So,
wait, what?
Are we talking about food or a board game or both?
A pizza cutter?
Natalie's outing me here.
Oh no!
What happened? What just happened?
I understand why you do it now. When you were explaining it on the last time we talked about this, I didn't understand what was being done, and I didn't understand the point, but then I looked at a forum thread about it, and I understand now. So I would like to apologize.
Full of extremely normal people.
Oh yeah, totally.
just nothing but normal people clipping their war game counters with, like, a giant hunk of sharpened steel. Yeah,
you know,
it actually does make a huge difference. So, so the way to put this, so I am playing with a friend of mine from Three Moves Ahead, Bruce Garrick. The classic wargaming problem is that not a ton of people play them. It's not like even your board game friends, you can't be like, hey, why don't you come over? We'll throw a war game down. We'll play it. Nobody's coming. Like, believe me, I know people will stop coming to your house if you're like, hey, we're just going to have a little ASL party. It'll be a blast. First, you should probably prep by reading these six rule books.
What's ASL?
Advanced Squad Leader.
Good.
Yeah.
Come on.
I'm sorry.
Danielle, you didn't do the reading before this podcast?
I'm sorry. I clearly didn't. I'm sorry.
Empire of the Sun, though, is interesting because I think there's a tendency if you look at computer war games, they tend to get more and more complex or just fussy, like throw more math at a problem to try to model things.
Okay.
Empire of the Sun attacks its subject from a really conceptual level. So it's trying to cover the entire arc of the war in the Pacific in World War II. And what it's trying to get across fundamentally is the island hopping nature of those campaigns.
Huh.
Why didn't, for instance, you know, once the U.S. Navy sort of had control of had superiority in the Pacific, why didn't you just sort of see the death ball strategy in World War II or stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes to some really clever representations of World War II, like naval combat, in ways that are exciting and unpredictable, but don't feel cheap. It's really something that, like, as I play it, I'm continually marveling at how well it is modeling something that is really tough to make fun if you're thinking inside the box. If you're thinking inside the box, this, like, the Pacific Theater is all about loading troops on ships and pushing them across the ocean, and it's the most boring shit. This streamlines a lot of that and abstracts it away and comes to some really, I think, brilliant representations of sort of the risk and reward dynamics that governed a lot of decisions in the Pacific.
Hmm. Could you paint me sort of like a picture of like a situation or like an example? Are you? Does it feel like you're simulating what actually happened, or is there a little bit more room for nuance, or it feels like sort of true to?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it feels like you're simulating what happened, but different things can still happen. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it's on rails where it's trying to like force you to reproduce historical outcomes. Uh-huh. Different things can happen in your version of history here, mm-hmm. but all of it will feel like stuff that plausibly could have happened if things go differently. So there are two major things that I think are key to understanding what sets this game apart. Every time you launch an operation on your turn, what you do is you play a card with a number on it. So let's like it goes up to four. Let's say you play an Operations 4 card.
Oh, shit.
That basically gives you four units you can activate that turn.
Oh, gotcha.
Then you look at your map, and there are headquarters units that also have a number on them. And that's sort of their base level command. So it's four plus whatever that headquarters unit is. Mm-hmm. But that can only activate units in their command range, basically. So you'll end up in these weird situations where, like, if you could just do whatever you wanted, you would have the right mix of troops for the job at hand. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they're scattered across two different commands. And so you, like, no matter who you activate, you end up having to leave some of what you want off on the side.
Gotcha.
But the other big thing is you play that four card. That's a really powerful activation card. The enemy, after you take your turn, after you make your move and begin the operation. So say you like at this point, battleships and carriers mm-hmm. are rolling out. Troops are on transports. They're heading toward an island to attack it. At this point, say the Japanese player, they get a chance to roll an intelligence check, and they have to roll like basically like under that. It's like their base intelligence number plus four. Uh-huh. So if you play a four card, it's a really high number. It's very easy for them to basically detect what you are up to. And then they get to before your action resolves, activate like seven units of their own. Or they could miss that intelligence check and like the scouts totally are asleep at the switch. They have no idea this operation happens. They don't get to react at all, which is great if you're attacking. But so you don't know when you make that move. Like it could be a completely like stealthy operation. Mm-hmm. You encounter no resistance. It's awesome. It could be the entire enemy fleet activates while you're making your move and they are waiting for you when you get
there. And there's no way for you to like pivot. You're just locked in. Oh, wow.
You're in it. And so, so it always feels, and this is the thing, like if you read about like naval combat, the ocean's huge. No, like nobody can see anything.
Yeah.
Like the enemy could be just over the horizon. You're never really sure. That's tough to do in a war game because like, especially a tabletop war game, because like you can look at the map.
Yeah.
You see where everyone is. But in this game, it always feels like every move you make, it could be, you know, you could have the entire enemy armada waiting for you, or you could have crickets. Who knows?
Does it feel like the game, what's like the typical play length of the game? Does it feel like it could end, like in these sort of circumstances, could end at any moment where you could just be devastated and the game's essentially lost? Or is there...
Yeah. Yes. So definitely like in the games I've played so far, there are a lot of cases where it feels like maybe it is not worth continuing past a certain point, which,
you know,
and one mood. Of the reasons, and I think one of the reasons for that is, when the combat begins, the combat is designed to be very swingy is the way I would put it. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not like two carrier groups clash at each other and, you know, they're both combat power 50 or something. Mm-hmm. And each does like 50 points of damage to the other. That's not how it works. You roll a dice to see how effective their strikes are, basically. And there is a chance you roll a dice that says you strike at double your combat power. That's a very narrow chance. There's also a chance you roll something that says you're only going to get to apply a quarter of your total combat power, which is slightly more likely. And the other part of this is, like, if you cannot do, like, fatal damage to a ship, nothing happens. So if a ship has 18 hit points and you have 17 combat power left over, that's wasted. You didn't hit.
Oh, so there's no, like, effect on the actual ship for... It's like an all or nothing sort of thing?
Yeah.
Got you.
And so you can have a combat where, like, you know, the same fleets could meet, and you could have an outcome where both of them basically, like, scratch each other, but barely any real damage is done, and combat breaks off, and nothing has changed all that much, despite being a huge engagement.
Yeah.
Or one side could get that double combat power thing, and basically in one battle, destroy the entire enemy fleet. At which point the entire game has been, like, thrown off balance.
Oh.
That's especially if that happens to the Japanese player, because they, like, this is sort of where the asymmetry in the game is. The Japanese player's just holding on. They can't really replace a lot of their losses. The Americans ultimately can. They're going to get more carriers. They're going to get more fighters. Japanese side, not so much. So it's really, like, it's a game that generates, like, constant suspense and dramatic moments.
Mm-hmm.
And I think gets at a lot of what makes, like, carrier warfare and, like, the Pacific and World War II interesting. But yeah, they're really clever solutions to, like, problems of design with the space.
That sounds super fascinating. I'm very enlightened at this moment. That sounds
maybe
really...
You should also go back and listen to our episode of Waypoints where we talked about it.
I was thinking about that the whole time as you're saying this. Right? I was like, fuck, like, wow.
Especially
we know those people that were, like, kind of tired and, like, might have missed something. Like, we just did 17 points of damage.
Exactly.
Yeah, we just did that podcast. If you haven't listened to it yet, our last episode of Waypoints, we talked about an excellent article from ProPublica. The USS Fitzgerald. It is a riveting, devastating read. I highly recommend it. And give our podcast a listen if you haven't already. All right. I think we can hit another game before our break. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the...
You have the power. Natalie, you can do...
This
don't,
is your
don't
show.
Don't look at Kato. You go as far as you want to go.
All right. Fuck it. No breaks. Fuck
Kato ass. Is just... He's... He can make suggestions. You go. You push this ship as far as you want to push it.
Okay,
you're the captain here of this ship.
I am the captain, and we are going to steer this train wreck into Patrick.
These mixed metaphors are just delicious.
I love vehicles,
spirit tracks.
Patrick, will you please give us your final thoughts on Anthem?
Yep, they deleted the game. I'm
never
going to play it.
Oh, good. I'm so happy for you.
So when I wrote a piece, they went up on Friday, sort of a compendium to Austin, Kato, and I talking through our time with Anthem so far, that went from, I'm just going to write like 700 words about Anthem, just we got something up so people, could read something. Of course, the most waypoint thing in the world, it's, you know, goes twice that, almost 2,000 words, and it's like,
an hour and a half podcast to accompany it.
Yeah, I was like, Rob, I think this is a review, even though I haven't seen the ending to this game. And so I spent some time getting closer to, like, the quote-unquote end of the campaign. And the one thing I just want to tack on to that review and the 90 minutes Kato, Austin, and I spent time with the game is that one of my chief complaints was just, like, a lack of identifiable and interesting characters, both in the main story and also in Fort Tarsis, which is sort of the hub place that you're in. And, like, tucked towards the end of the game is, like, a hint at nothing. You know, there are fundamental issues with Anthem, but, like, different paths that could have been taken. There is this character, Sentinel Dax, this just unbelievably funny, brash, interesting woman that has, like, a really interesting and emotional arc. It's like this 90 minutes that you spend with her solving a certain mystery that is related to your larger quest.
Oh, so this is within the main game, not a side quest. This is like the main storyline.
Yeah. But it's not someone like you spent like, you know, 20 hours with. They just kind of come in towards the last second. You know, one of the things that, like, the way you encounter characters in Anthem is, you know, it's a third person action game, but in first person for the hub sections. I don't know why. For whatever reason, they chose to do that. I don't think it's an advantage. I think it was just a weird choice that doesn't – it's just weird. Mm-hmm. But the way you encounter characters is, like, someone's kind of, like, standing up next to a table or something like that. You kind of square in on them, and they just have, like, not much life to their animations. Like, there's just not a lot of character imbued in, like, the actual animation work of the models. And that's just not the case here. Like – Sentinel Dax immediately establishes herself as this, like, her personality is established really quickly. I almost don't even really give away the character traits that are imbued because the actual actions that occur are, like, really funny and interesting. But in, like, 90 seconds communicates more character, like, than all of the other characters I had encountered in Anthem to date wrapped into one.
Yeah.
And it was both, like, really cool and also frustrating given the low bar that occurs elsewhere. But, you know, if you're looking for, oh, there are, like, threads they could tug at to, like, build something different going forward, like, Sentinel Dax gave me hope that, like, however they landed on this arc, if you could just give me, like, 15 of these, like, over the next year, like, this could, you know, help at least provide a path towards a different game that was a little more splitting the difference on a BioWare/Destiny/Diablo style game. So, really liked Dax, and I don't think there's that much more of stuff like that in the game because I'm knocking on the end. But Dax was a really standout character that I wish I could have squeezed in to my review, but I hadn't encountered her yet. But for folks that are maybe playing it that are looking for that, you will know Dax when you meet her, and she is a true delight.
That's so fascinating what you say about, you know, her animations having so much character, because in the first, like, I played, like, the first hour or two, maybe, of Anthem, and then just got distracted by anime. The characters are, like, heavily animated. Like, they're very, they have, like, a lot of, like, hand, like, I'm thinking of, like, the first encounter you have with Owen, I think his name is, and his, like, hands are all over the place, but there's something that's, like, feels a little empty behind it, or, like, it's, like, impressive, but maybe not, like, super, like, connected.
It doesn't, like, kind of communicate anything about, like, very little about the characters themselves. Like, yes, there are, like, every character has sort of, like, grand sweeping.
They're lively, but not effective.
Yeah. Yes. Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Absolutely. And
Dax.
That's the difference with Dax. I'd say another character, Faye, that you encounter about halfway through the game, also has some pretty decent animation work that at least says something that, like, feels in line with some of the dialogue you have with her. She also is a character that, like, as I got towards the last, like, fifth or so, has some really. She's what in the game world is called a cipher, which is basically like a sort of like a. They have a link to the Anthem of Creation. I'm like, I can see myself rolling my eyes as I start going down this path. But basically, they're sort of like telepaths that have a link towards the people who are in the exosuits, and then also towards, like, the larger tools of creation in the world, sort of like the godlike stuff that, like, is lying around this area. Mm-hmm. And often when you're going up to talk to characters, it's like something weighty and serious and, like, the mission that you're working towards. And there's, like, three different times you go up to talk to her, and she just wants to fangirl out about Dawn Guard, an in-game radio drama that is basically the way she talks about Dawn Guard is the way that, like, Waypoint talks about anime. And, like, talks about, like, hating certain characters and how she loves to hate certain characters. And, like, it's just so delicious and weird and, like, out of step for a lot of the writing in the world. But is really good and actually reveals, like, so much more about who this person is and what their, like, proclivities. And it says a lot without saying very much by the fact that they choose to reveal this particular trait about Faye and her interests, and it was also, yeah, just a really, really good moment. But yeah, like, it's a lot of characters that are moving their hands,
yeah,
but it doesn't actually tell you a lot about who they are.
Yeah, totally. Well, I guess there's hope in Anthem.
There's hope in Dax. So.
Yeah, I'm still playing it.
Yeah.
Hey, Kato, I know you're off mic, but Bastion is not the world. It's a country.
What?
Because I just did a piece of dialogue where they were talking about, like, I came to Bastion from... we got to look into this, because I don't think Bastion. It's not the name of the planet.
Waypoint Investigates.
Bastion. Kato is upset.
Right? I'm sorry, Kato. I just knew you would appreciate that. I don't know if any of this is going to pick them off mic, but Kato is having a moment off screen as I revealed this to him.
Bastion's just the kid from the Neverending Story. I don't know.
Like, I still don't know exactly how it works, Kato, but, like, there was a line of dialogue where someone said, like, yeah, I came over to Bastion from X. And I'm like, what?
Damn.
Oh, wow.
I guess it could be another planet, but there's not a lot of suggestion that there's interplanetary... Wow. Travel
weird
happens.
Way to stealth reveal a partnership with Supergiant.
Wow. Good.
I gotta play that game, man. That Bastion's game. Or the Supergiant's game. Fucking Anthem. Okay, anyway. Yep, that's Anthem.
I think Patrick needs a break.
Yep.
I think we all need a break. I'm gonna steer this boat into a dock and maybe gas it up a little. And then we'll take another sail. Be right back. Wait, you don't need...
Rob's dead.
You don't need
sales. That's the end of the podcast. Actually, Waypoint's over. Guessed.
Okay, I knew that. I knew that. Goodbye.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Captain, could we have some shore leave?
Yes. I don't even know how the fuck my boat works, apparently. I don't know about wind, I guess.
Captain Natalie of the SS Waypoint.
I need to learn about my ship, apparently. All right, we're all gassed up. Sails are up. Down. Sails are down. We're ready to sail. All right, here we go.
Kyle, just keep all this it's in. All
turning the engine on. Mm-hmm. Wind is blowing.
Wait, so we have a gas engine, but we're also using the wind?
Yeah. It was
what if
thing,
we
Patrick.
Need to turn off the gas?
Okay. Uh-huh.
What if we need to turn off the
what
gas?
What if the wind dies?
What if the wind dies? Okay, all actually, right. I'm not as much of a fool as I once thought 30 seconds ago. This actually makes sense. What if the wind died and you were stuck in the middle of the ocean? What would you do? Row? No. You just fucking turn on that engine, and you take off.
Is this the podcast ad?
Boats by Natalie.
What if you're out?
Come by a
row.
Boat.
No.
Becalmed again.
Wow.
Have you been in this situation where the wind dies?
You're on a boat.
Use promo code.
No matter how many Jonas you keep casting into the murky depths, the wind won't come back. Son, you need an engine.
Gas it up.
All right. I'm steering us into a new direction, into new waters. These waters are a little scary.
Oh, they're spooky
they're
waters.
They're a little spooky. Danielle, what's going on here? Why are the waters so spooky?
They're real scary. There's just some really scary waters. This is a two-part discussion.
Okay.
Because I want to talk about Devotion, the game, a really wonderful horror game. There's also some kerfuffle around Devotion, Ooh. The game. So let's start with what Devotion is. It's a spooky game.
Yeah.
I think it's a really great spooky game.
Is it and good scary?
Good scary. Yes, okay. The best kind of scary. I think it's a very good horror game. It came out last week. I played it. We're going to have a review on the site today.
I'm excited
also
to read that.
Also spooky because we're talking about the future. Whoa. Predictions. It is a first-person horror game set in 1980s Taiwan. There's sort of three characters. There's like a father who's a screenwriter. There's a young daughter and a wife who was a sort of ex-star, singer, songwriter, movie star who kind of quits her job to become a wife and a mother. And there's a lot of domestic drama. I don't want to spoil anything, but the game takes place in their home. In three different time periods, in 1980, 1985, and 1986. And there's a lot of things that happen. There are ghosts and spooky things, but there's also a lot of sort of domestic drama and the sort of the stuff of life. And it's tied in really nicely and really neatly with the really sort of spooky, scary stuff with ghosts and hauntings and religious fanaticism, let's say.
Would you compare that interweaving to something like Haunting of Hill House?
Yeah, I think it's done in a similar fashion with the sort of melodrama nicely complementing spooky ghosts and spooky things and creepy things happening. There's a lot of really great doll imagery. There's a lot of really good there's a lot of religious imagery as well. The game is called Devotion partially because throughout the story, people's devotion to various things becomes a very, very sort of dominant thread, and it has a lot to do with what kind of happens. And, you know, I wouldn't call it like, oh, there's only one big reveal and that reveals everything that happens. I think it's a little smarter and more subtle than that.
Gotcha.
There are some big shocking things that kind of happen throughout the story, and that requires, you know, the usual content warning for anything that could happen in a horror story, which includes a lot of violence and self-violence and all sorts of other stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I found it very effective and very spooky and very sad in a lot of ways. Like, I think it does a really great job with sort of domestic drama. And also, here's all the bad things that happen in life. Like, illnesses happen. Family deaths happen. Family strife happens. Gender happens. Like, all these kinds of things happen in anybody's life. And I always love when horror sort of heightens that and makes it feel even more sort of present and, you know, actually makes it really – makes you feel it in a really intense way. This game is also pretty scary, and it got me a few times with some jump scares and some, like,
well,
really disturbing
say, like,
stuff.
I was going to think – yeah, can you sort of – I was curious if you could – I haven't played this yet. It's on my list. I know it's only, like, 2 hours long. I know the game they made – the studio made before this was also one that people have been yelling
Detention,
to play.
Right?
Apparently
Detention,
it's really good.
Yeah.
But, like horror can mean all sorts of different things. Like some games, especially like shorter, like stream friendly games rely overtly on jump scares as a way of like, both the player and the audience member are participating in the game, and it's explicitly built around that. Whereas this one seems a little more story focused. So I was curious if you could kind of expand a little bit on like how it actually tries to dole out its tension and its scares, and like, I guess, how reliant is it on jump scares to solely communicate sort of like scares to the player?
Yeah, there are a few jump scares, but I wouldn't call that the dominant force here. I would call this a much smarter and more subtler take on something like A Layers of Fear, but again, much smarter, much subtler, much more about the actual story and the characters. It's also much more puzzle-based than something like a PT or Layers of Fear. You actually have an inventory, and you're actually know, using like an adventure game style inventory. Nowhere near the level of like, oh my god, what puzzle, you know, you're not doing the
but you're carrying stuff,
cat
like you,
feather
there's
thing.
At least a little bit of point A to point B. And
yeah, absolutely. And sort of knowing that, okay, here's the 1980 version of this house, here's the 1985, here's the 1986, like figuring out what happened when is a huge part of it. So it is, it does really bolster the story. Everything feels very like, okay, this makes sense in terms of solving a puzzle. Like, I think I'll figure out the code to open something through this hint that, oh, it makes sense because I remember seeing this here. Like, it all actually makes a lot of sense. You're not going to be sitting there. I got stuck once for like a couple of minutes because I misinterpreted something, but it was very easy to actually figure out what it was once I kind of sat there and I was like, okay, right, yes, this is the favorite photo. Okay, I'm going to go back and see where this was, that kind of thing. So yeah, it, again, like very of that ilk of like a first person kind of walking simulator, scary type of game, but with much more emphasis on puzzle and story and just sort of making sense of this world and this family's interactions than just, oh, that was scary. oh, this was scary. You know, like this thing happened, that thing happened. Yeah. It also does a little bit of genre jumping, which I thought was really nice. I won't spoil how or why it does that, but there are sequences that are completely not what you'd expect for this type of game, which I thought was really nice. And it does a lot to sort of shift perspective from one character's point of view to another character's point of view.
Do you feel like that heightens sort of like the horror tension, or do those feel like breaks to kind of like take a step back?
Yes.
Or
both. In one context, and again, I don't want to spoil it, but in one context, it really tells you so much about the father-daughter relationship in a really beautiful way, like a really sort of, you know, very heartfelt and really nice way. And in another context, more towards the end of the game, in a really terrifying and heightened way that was like, oh, they went there. They went to a place with this game. And it felt earned because, again, you spend so much time with these characters. You spend so much time learning about their daily lives, the boring parts of their lives, and the, you know, emotional trauma and drudgery of their lives, that it felt very earned to go to this place, this very, very, very heightened sort of emotional place. So I found it very effective as a game.
So I know detention was kind of explicitly about the authoritarian politics of like 70s and 80s Taiwan. This is a similar era, but like it sounds like overwhelmingly it is focused on the domestic, but is there still kind of a political backdrop to this that the game is trying to sort of keep in mind?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, there gender politics especially are sort of discussed in the fiction of the game in a really good and interesting way. Mm-hmm. And certainly this sets up the sort of controversy that happened around this game, where the game was review bombed. So, you know, a few days ago on Steam, it had really positive reviews. And then it came out that, you know, I'm going to oversimplify this here. There's a Polygon story about it. There's several stories about it. But the game was actually review bombed by Chinese gamers. Again, this is a Taiwanese team, and it's a game set in Taiwan. And in the game, there is a poster that sort of unfavorably made fun of the Chinese president, sort of comparing him to Winnie the Pooh, which is a whole thing, or Pooh Bear. It is Winnie the Pooh, sorry.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, there's a meme going back a number of years in which, the now current president of China, Xi Jinping, was compared to Winnie the Pooh, and it became like a whole thing, and worked to be removed from cultural works and private discussion through the use of censorship tools.
Yeah. So this ended up in the game. There's a poster that has this in it. And when it was sort of noticed, the game started getting review bombed by Chinese players. And the studio has since posted an apology and since said, oh, this was on accident. It was an asset that was left in. It was like a placeholder asset. That was sort of part of this whole apology.
They said that like in their development stage, like a lot of like environmental art when it's temporary, which is true. That is like absolutely the case that a lot of environment art that is not primary art will be placeholder and then swapped for something else. Mm-hmm. But they said specifically like, oh, we use a lot of memes when we do that stuff and then we change it later, which...
What a good idea that could not possibly go wrong.
I also don't buy it. I think that was their way of trying to come up with a plausible explanation when it's probably just the case that it is possible that it was oversight. It is also possible that they – I believe there has been some work done to look – one of the lead developers has said some critical things about the Chinese government. And so like – there's a lot more reason to think that they just didn't think this would either be discovered or be such a big deal, or that this game is not only popular, but has become extremely popular, especially in China, where like the major Chinese streamers and like it's been really embraced. Uh-huh. And so the backlash has been sharp in a way that probably developers couldn't have anticipated for what they thought was just taking their politics into an offhand joke. And then this game got very popular amongst a certain section of, society. And it's all the more precarious because of the way game development and publishing works in China, where it's like if this game is found to be making fun of the Chinese government, the game and developer can just be banned outright from, you know, releasing over there. So like there's just a lot of ripple effects where you understand how they end up at like a very weird explanation for why they would do this.
Totally.
Yeah, I kind of don't blame them. I'll just read from the Polygon story, just a quick graph here that says a recent error user noted, however, that most Chinese gamers' ire drew not from the mockery of Xi, but rather that they felt the game was mocking mainlanders for being tricked into buying something that makes fun of him. User noted that scan of social media channels for Red Candle Games founder and lead designer turned up several posts showing his political views, including support for Taiwanese independence and recognition, an extremely controversial and antagonistic stance to mainland China. So yeah, it's very... a bit of a fraught situation, and it's interesting because I was sort of writing this review on Friday when a lot of this was sort of going down, and of course I can't read Chinese. I wouldn't have, you know, necessarily or known that context. That
nor
like,
are
oh,
we
this
like
is making
deep
fun
experts
of,
on like yeah. like you know interregional Chinese politics.
Right.
That I wouldn't pretend to be able to understand.
Right,
that.
Of course. So I'm not. I didn't play the game and notice that on any level, of course. But. It was very interesting to be sort of like blown away, honestly, by how impactful and well done and you know, subtle is always a term to use for a horror game, right? Horror is not a subtle genre, but for this type of game, I felt like it weaves some things very subtly, not in every place, but in a lot of ways. And then sort of seeing this controversy, I was sort of like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know how to necessarily feel about that. So I don't write about that in my piece or anything, but mm-hmm. It is very... Man, I certainly have feelings on review bombing and how ugly of a weapon that is, sort of to bludgeon a piece of work, certainly. So,
oh yeah,
quite a bit going on there, certainly. Do you want me to steer the ship to the next? Or
yeah.
Do you want to steer the ship? You're the captain. You steer the ship.
Yeah.
from Taiwan in the 80s to all over the world in the 2020s. What era are we in? The 20-teens still?
Now? I guess we're in the 20-teens. We're nearing the end of the 20-teens.
Yeah.
And I see something rising in the distance. Danielle, could you please tell me, what is that thing I see rising?
It's a bike.
Oh, it's a bike?
A motocross bike.
It's a motocross
bike.
Oh, no,
it's rising, and it's rising, and oh, no, now its rider has landed on his head. And,
oh, no.
Oh, that's
in the water?
Unfortunate, in the water.
Yeah.
The train sailboat is...
Yeah, honestly,
got
this
a BMX
happen.
Track on it?
It does happen in
this,
a trials game.
These waters do, let me tell you.
If you use promo code BMX, we'll throw in.
Good. Natalie, I've been playing Trials Rising.
How is it?
It's so much fun.
Yeah?
It's a really, really fun game. I've never played a Trials game. I should tell you that first.
Okay.
This is baby's first Trials.
But you have played motocross games in the past.
Yes, I have. This is so much more of like a platformer.
Okay.
Than like a motocross game. You are on a set track. It's almost like, okay, it's like a physics-based platformer. You're on a bike. And you're doing wild obstacles. So you start off in North America. That's where the first, you know, set of tracks are. There are a lot of tracks in this game, let me tell you. It's a 2D game with 3D art, basically. Mm-hmm. But you're on mm-hmm. a 2D plane. And you have this bike that is very tipsy-turny. Mm-hmm. And you're going over wild ramps. And you're getting ridiculous air. And there's crazy obstacles. There are things like cars that could drive into you. There are roller coaster tracks. You might do loop-de-loops like Sonic.
Okay.
But you always have to go through... try to keep your speed relative.
Yeah.
And land on two tires or at least land in such a way that doesn't immediately kill your rider so you can move on to the next obstacle.
That sounds stressful.
It's extremely fun. The physics are a lot of fun. You know, it is a trials game. And everyone tells me this is sort of the fun of a trials game is that it's this wacky, you know, it's basically like controlling a pretty wacky sort of vehicle that's a little, you know, your front wheel and your back wheel, you can kind of lean. Leaning back and leaning forth so that you actually can kind of land and continue going. You can do tricks. You can do flips. You can kind of like bunny hop on your back wheel. You can do wacky things like that. I'm not quite there yet. I've gotten through the first, you know, few worlds of the game, you know, the first few sort of areas of the game, basically. And I think the embargo was up a few hours ago, so we can talk about whatever, basically.
Yeah. I'm curious if you've seen any sort of like... room for creativity in terms of like not necessarily sequence breaking but like moving through that 2D space in a way that is like unexpected or is like not the you know set path or anything like that.
Well, there's a lot of weird things you can do, and there are different paths through. Oh, like, once you start getting past, you know, the first few courses, there really are sort of, like, almost Sonic-style routes. Okay. Like, oh, here's the best route. You can go real fast through this loop-de-loop and real fast up this ramp. You can get a little more air, and you can kind of get to the higher track or the lower track.
Oh,
or there's,
gotcha.
You know, certain other paths kind of going on. So it really is kind of a platformer more than it is a racing game, even though there are racing-style events and things like that. But yeah, it is. It does feel like a very, like, physics-y Sonic. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Physics-y Sonic. Yes, Rob.
I mean, there's a couple things. Usually when I see people posting videos of trials, it looks exasperating. Because often the videos I see are when things are going wrong and someone is, like, falling off the track. And to me at that point, it looks a lot like, and I think, you know, I was talking to Austin about this, it looks like Getting Over It.
Yes.
In some ways, but on a bike. But in a way that, like, that has never really appealed to me too much, because that whole, like, process of fail, and just keep grinding away until you, like, figure out the attack on the course has always seemed a little bit tiring. And so I'm curious, like, to what degree is it you sitting there trying to execute the same jump over and over to, like, figure out the solution versus you being Sonic on a bike, sort of racing hell for leather through a level. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, to what degree is it like, oh man, trying to try this jump 50 fucking times versus here I go through this ridiculous obstacle course?
I feel like I'm being judged as someone that likes the, yeah, let's do this jump for the 51st time. And like, Rob is just like subtweeting me in this podcast right now.
That Mario Maker feeling, you know, physics-y Mario Maker.
Yeah, what's wrong with doing it wrong 50 times? Once you get it right, you only got to get it right once.
I mean, it's true. I think this game actually does a really good job with onboarding, especially from what I've seen also and what I knew of Trials. Again, this is my first Trials, so baby's
first
time.
Yeah, this is like the sixth or something. I'm pulling that number out of my ass.
Whole series.
Like it's
For sure. There's a Trials University now. That gives you, even from like baby level lessons about how to lean properly. You should lean when you're going up a hill, and you should lean back when you're going down a hill. And here's how to get flow correct. And it actually does a really, really good job of kind of putting you through the very basic skills you need to at least get started. So you're not just doing that from the beginning, basically. And the first courses are actually very easy. You know, you will screw up a bunch, but you can also immediately reset, and checkpointing is very generous. It feels like I have gotten stuck on a few jumps and a few kind of things here and there, but I've never felt like that lasted for a very long amount of time. It also does the really good thing where you typically have like six tracks you can go to. So if you're getting stuck in one place, I did get stuck on a windmill course in the Europe area. And like, I got annoyed with that. And I went to like, there were seven other places I could go, which always helps. I always really appreciate that in a platformer, because it's like, you know how much I love platformers. I love me a good platformer. But if I get stuck in one area, I might, you know, want to dropkick the cartridge, you know, to use old timey speak about how you feel about
one
games.
One thing I would say to speak to, so Rob, it is that kind of game. Like Trials always has been a bang your head against sequences. It's like trying to do the time faster, sharing that with your friends, sort of thing. But I think one of the ways it like smartly, whether by accident or by on purpose, there is humor in the failure that is meant to mitigate the frustration, right? So it's one thing to play like a difficult platformer where in dying it's just brutal and it's mean on your fingers and there's nothing to laugh at. It's just you fucked up and just do it again. But in Trials, like when things go wrong, it's like so goofy and weird. Like you often can't help but laugh at like the way the physics have just gone so terribly wrong that they're in that loop is a way of mitigating the frustration of you're just doing this jump for the 30th time. Because the way things go wrong and the goofiness of it is I think part of trying to help you know, kind of grease that friction when you need to try it over and over again. And also, as Dana pointed out, not only is the checkpointing system good, it, like Super Meat Boy and other platformers, if you're going to make something that forces you to die over and over, it needs to be extremely snappable to you trying that again. Mm. Like, the time, any time wasted in between you trying that jump again is time that you're going to be like, I could be doing something else. And while I haven't played this new Trials, the series in the past has been very good at making sure, boom, like, just get in there and try it again. So that both stylistically, aesthetically, and functionally, you don't have that much time to ruminate over your frustration because you're just trying again very quickly and you can just give it another go.
Yeah, there's a lot of the sort of ragdolling that grievous bodily harm is very much like a joke here. And there's a course where I definitely if your rider's head hits the track, that counts as a crash. But I was able at one point with one track, I was sort of, my bike was almost completely turned all the way around. But for some reason, I had like an inch of clearance for my rider's head. And I was able to go from like three different checkpoints, just dragging them a little bit until I finally made the next checkpoint. And I was like, nailed it, and was able to kind of start from there, which is always good. So
that's
really
good.
And it's Trials Arising for you. It's a fun-ass game. Fun-ass video game.
Is this one on Switch?
It is, yes. Switch, Xbox, okay, PS4,
hell
PC.
Yeah.
Oh,
perfect Switch game.
On Switch, I wonder if it has that snappiness try again thing, right? Like, is it going to be as quick to get you back to the jump on Switch as it is elsewhere?
I think it is.
Where are you playing it, Danielle?
I'm on PS4.
Okay.
I'm watching, like, some videos of gameplay, and I think it, I mean, I don't see why it would be different on Switch, but it does seem pretty snappy. Like, every time I see this little ragdoll Play-Doh man,
you just hit circle,
fly something.
At least on PS4, it's been pretty snappy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I
awesome.
I could not speak to the Switch version, not yet. Anyway,
seems
again,
like
we
a really
speak
good
of the future.
Yeah, seems like a really good Switch game.
Yeah.
All right, I think we have. One last, I need to talk about something. If you haven't, do you have any more thoughts on?
No, that's my trials.
Okay.
Those are the trials of Danielle.
The trials have ended.
Yes. Yes.
And now we're dropping boys into.
What?
Into Apex Legends. My favorite game of the moment for some reason that I can't put my finger on. I don't know why I love it so much, but I cannot stop playing it. I've been playing it every single night, mainly with Waypoints Joel and Colin from Noisy, who has been
on the podcast. I didn't know Colin was such a gamer.
Oh, Colin is carrying me to new heights, both Colin and Joel.
Wait, I could be playing Ape Legs with Colin instead of just emailing him about ambient music.
You could.
Is Apex Legends such a long fucking name that you needed to call it Ape Legs?
Ape Legs.
I like Ape Legs. It's good, in my opinion. Hey, something really good. The reason why I'm talking about this is because I did a thing this weekend, which was get a fucking win for the first time.
Yes.
In Apex Legends, it was a beautiful play, and I just want to clap. Woo! Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, wait, hold on. Did it end on a beautiful play?
It did.
Like,
on my
all right,
part.
Take us through it. Take us through that moment.
So, it was me, Joel, and Colin. It was, we had like three or four teams left, and I died. And they had to.
That's not a good play.
It's not. Well, hold on.
You're getting ahead of the play.
Hold on.
Rob?
I had died.
Okay.
And I was just, this actually, there were like five teams left. I had died. They went to recover my banner, and I dropped in. And when you drop back in to Apex Legends after dying, you have nothing. So I'm just running around grabbing what I can, and I have a level one shield, which is nothing for endgame. And I have like no healing, and we're just running by, and then we see a loot crate or a supply crate drop down, and it's unopened. And we go over, and Joel, or I'm running ahead because like the circle's coming in and I'm stressed out and I'm weak and vulnerable. And Joel's like, hey, there's a mastiff in here. Now, if you don't know what a mastiff is, it is a gun that you can only get from a supply crate. So I'm pretty sure you can only get it from there.
Huh.
I don't know. Anyway, I think you can only, I've only ever seen it in a supply crate. And you cannot, it has unique ammo, so you cannot, you can't put any attachments on it. You can't reload it. It comes with, you get, it's like a four, you get four shots and you get 20 total ammo. So this is, I was like, I'm not good at shotguns and I'm not.
Is it like, okay, yeah.
I'm not, yeah, it's a shotgun. It's a shotgun. And it has a pretty gnarly kickback. So it's kind of hard to control. And I'm bad at video games, so I was like,
welcome to Waypoint.
I was like, maybe this is not for me. And Joel was like, I don't know, maybe you should just take it. You don't have anything else. And I was like, that's true. I have like a Mozambique probably in a pistol. Or no, I had some AR or like an SMG or something. So I pick up the Mastiff for my second gun. And we're running into, I think it was Skull Town, and which, you know, is my favorite spot. Okay. We're running into Skull Town. There's three teams left, and Joel and Colin are ahead of me. I'm like still trying to loot because I have nothing to protect me. And they're like, oh, here, they're here. And I was like, okay. And I like run over. It's like I'm in one building, and then there's like, I leave the building and there's a big stretch of like open area and then another building that I like just run right into and around. And then there's a hallway in the building and Joel and Colin are there attacking and the enemy team pops a smoke screen. And it's unclear how many people are there or like inside how many teams are there. It's just like on one side of the hallway, we have like me, Joel and Colin. And then on the other side, it's just smoke. And so we have no idea what's happening. And I come in and I quickly switch to my Mastiff for some reason, which I guess because it was like going to be close range, I assumed. And I hit three shots directly in front of me. And then for some like intuitive reason, I like move my reticle like slightly to the right and I get the final shot like in the smoke. Like I can't see shit. I can't see anything. And I just, for some reason, the last shot, I just like moved just slightly to the right, and that was the final kill. And then we were the Apex champions. And
yes!
And there's a.
That's incredible.
I uploaded the video onto my Twitter, but I didn't have party chat on, so it's just me. And it's like just my reactions like, okay, I think one. And then it's like it's very funny just to hear like only my reactions and not Joel and Colin feeding me information. But it felt so good. It finally happened. I've gotten second a lot of times and I've gotten third like a lot more. And Apex is getting to a place now where everyone is really good. And it's like kind of like my relationship to it is like I'm not going to be incredibly good at this game. Like I'm never going to be like top tier at this game. It's not like something like Overwatch where, you know, in Apex you can get to know your characters really well and you can kind of figure out like good times to use their ultimates and stuff, but in Overwatch you can like train in a way that like actually gets you good at the game. And there's still so much luck in Apex of like luck of the draw. Like, are you dropping in an area with like a lot of people and you just happen to land in the building that doesn't have a gun? And like, so
and also just like, how good are you at headshots, right?
Exactly.
Like there's like just like there is nothing that Apex Legends can do to remove that part of it. I do think it's like a far more this is anecdotally, I don't know how like the statistically this would bear out, but I friends of mine that didn't necessarily get into Fortnite and PUBG have spent more time with this game because they seem to get closer to a win or close enough that it feels like they had a good time and there's a reason to play again, as opposed to what can often happen in Fortnite and PUBG, which for some people, including myself, which sometimes it was part of the appeal, was like it was humorous to get into a match, get headshotted 20 seconds in, boom, let's go again.
Yeah.
It just seems like that happens not quite as often, and or like the fights are such an Apex, and I've only played, you know, 10, 12 matches, so I'm certainly no expert either. I don't know, it just seems like you can get further and feel like you've had more success in an average Apex match, especially on the console versions. Maybe this is less true on PC, where keyboard and mouse is just a higher skill floor naturally. But I don't know. I've seen people who normally are turned off by those games enjoying it or finding enjoyment in it where, it is going to be frustrating as, the skill floor increases because people are spending more time with it. And it's the kind of thing where it's like, I really enjoyed the first month with it. But, once we hit month six and, there's 20 more weapons and all that, it's just I don't know where I fit into this equation as someone that's would like to play it once every couple of weeks.
I don't think there's been a lot of updates yet. There's been one new gun that has dropped, the Havoc, which is an energy auto rifle, which is a lot of fun. I guess I'm paying attention to things, but it really is just I have to maintain this relationship to it that I'm not going to be good at it, because otherwise I would get very sad because I die. But the fact that you are constantly participating in the game, you're constantly even if you're bad at shooting, you can be hey, there's ammo over here.
That shot was good, by the way.
I was watching it. That's where I was holy
and,
shit.
Your exact description of just I don't know, just kind of push the reticle an inch to the right. Because you do. There's no evidence for why.
Nope.
You were clearly just taking pot shots, and it's beautiful.
What video games are to me.
There is a shape moving. There is a shape moving in the murk, though. There is a small flicker of movement that Natalie appears to be tracking in on. It's real good.
Maybe
I thought this would be the clip that was going to get her banned.
Oh, boy.
I thought, Natalie was going to log in tonight and be like, I'm banned. And that was going to be that.
No, I'm just, I guess, there's something deep within me that is, there's a pro gamer inside that I need to hone. I need to bring it out.
But I do think this game, you can find those moments more frequently, more often than I have found maybe it's because our own familiarity. We're like Fortnite, we hit an obstacle where it's just none of us wanted to put in the time and effort to really understand the building stuff other than just creating walls around us.
Yeah.
And Apex Legends and PUBG is so much more it really can just be a one shot. And that it often is the case where it's if someone gets the jump on you, it's binary. It's they're going to kill you or it's not often that an actual sort of fight breaks out where there's a cat and mouse and there are dynamics. And Apex Legends, that is just much more likely to happen in my experience, where it's just when shots start ringing down, there's still an opportunity for you to do something about it.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's just the sheer longevity of your participation in a match makes it feel more enjoyable, even if you don't end up winning or even actively sort of killing that many people.
Mm-hmm.
Just sheer participation gives an investment that just isn't in the loop as much on those other games.
Totally. I feel I know what I'm getting myself into no matter where I drop. I've internalized enough that okay, if I'm going into the hot loot zone, I know I'm going to get into firefights, and then I'm not going to be that bummed if I don't get out, because I could be dropping with five teams and I could just get totally pinched. Or I'm okay, I can play the long game and maybe I'll drop with one other team, and I'm watching them and I'm paying attention to where they're landing. And I think just the there is an accessibility to familiarity with weapons and how they feel and what your attachments are doing. PUBG's attachments, you really have to learn what the fuck you're putting on your gun. I felt most of the time I was doing that, it was super arbitrary. And Apex is no, just take this, it's better. Here's the better thing.
You don't
this,
have to read. There
bad.
Are all those stats, but it's just good one.
Yeah.
Click. And you're thank you.
Yeah. It's very helpful to those who don't want to spend time reading up on all that stuff. So.
Well, because that stuff is probably marginally advantageous in a match in a way that you and I do not understand.
Yeah.
And so
I mean,
the fact that the.
Yeah. You can.
Well,
because
just the fact
it's
that the game
simplified.
Communicates it for you.
Yeah. Because it's more simplified. You're not there aren't different types of each category of attachment. There's just better. And the only variety is really in scope. And that's where you can kind of be oh no, I want a shittier scope because I don't want to be as close up or whatever. Or so you don't have to the way that the gun feels when you're putting better stuff on it is like pretty singular. Like you, it's like a singular path to like, okay, you're going to have less kickback. You're going to have less, you know, what's it called when you shoot something and then it like it's moving around a lot. Do you know what
recoil?
I mean? Yeah. Recoil. Mm.
Jutter, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So with all, like all of those things feel like you can kind of feel that gradient in a more like singular way, instead of there being like a lot of leeway between what different types of attachments might do. So Apex is good. I'm still playing it every single night. And, I want to find like something about it. 'Cause I feel like there's something there for me, but I don't know what hasn't been said other than that it's like extremely accessible and like fun. And I think the smaller like size, the fact that it's only 60 people instead of 100, probably, you know, there's something there in terms of like game lengths and congestive and, you know, areas and stuff like that. So Apex is good, IMO, except for the fact that they don't have any fucking reporting systems, and oof, there is a lot of bad. So that's my other thing, is that Apex is good.
Wow, way to put Colin on blast.
Oh!
No, Colin is one of the few goods. Colin and Joel and I are the leaders of the good movement.
Goods.
And unfortunately, wow, there is just a lot of absolute horseshit in bad people making bad usernames and being in chat and being bad. And so hopefully this next they've said that they're going to release a reporting system, but it's mainly directed at cheating. So hopefully they take the sort of harassment and inappropriate stuff very seriously, because it's a problem.
Yes.
I think we might have time for a question. Rob, maybe you can give us your answer first and then dip out. Or should we save it for another?
It's such a good question.
It's a good question. I think this is like a 20-minute conversation.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's save it.
Let's do this one next time.
Let me look at it. Ooh, it's okay, real yes, good. This is a good one. Yeah,
is
so we should wait.
Is a ship a boat?
Is yes?
Ship boat.
My opinion is yes. Ships and boats.
It's
not
a rocket, a boat.
All ships are boats, but not all boats are ships.
What about a spaceship?
Is a square-rigged sailing saying vessel augmented
wait
by
wait
steam
oh
the finest sailing?
Spaceships are boats.
What?
More than they are planes.
Yeah.
This is a conversation that was in the yeah motherboard Slack, and I agree. What do you do in the void? What do you do in space? Do you fly through space, or do you float?
You sail.
I mean, like, the engine is kind of like the same. You're kind of paddling in space, sort of, right? Mm.
Well, what if you're using a solar sail?
You're sailing. Yeah. You're sailing like a ship, like a boat.
Yeah. So I'm team spaceships or boats.
Team, yeah, I'm on boats.
Yeah.
I mean, not right now, but
on board the boat.
If you have opinions about spaceships and boats and video games and whatever else might tickle your fancy.
Yeah, why is there like a space fantasy world where the ships actually look like the spaceships really do look more like boats?
I think that's called Sunless Skies.
Oh.
Is it not?
They look like trains.
Oh, right, they're trains.
Hence Natalie's confusion at the start of the, like, now, what's a boat? Like, Natalie's like, oh yeah, like Sunless Skies has boats. A locomotive like chugs past. Like,
that's a boat,
frame,
right? That's a boat.
It's a good boat.
I love to sail a fucking locomotive across the waters on my spare time. If you have thoughts, please send them to gaming@vice.com. We will see them and perhaps we will answer them.
Your e-mails.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Danielle Riendo, where are people finding you on the internet?
I'm the good ship at Danielle RI on Twitter.
Great. Rob, please.
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
Patrick.
At Patrick Klupik.
Shout out Staccato doing the damn thing on on technology at @A_Kato_appears on Twitter.
I was really hoping you'd fuck that up.
I'm not going to because I'm a good ass host.
I was really like, man, I will feel less bad
I'm
after
a good fucking host.
A boat appears.
A boat appears.
Underscore boat underscore appears. And it the header image is just a fucking train.
You can all right, register that Twitter account immediately.
Oh, there he goes.
Please. You can find everything we do on Twitter at Waypoint. You can find us most other places at Waypoint or at Waypoint Vice. both may work. Who could say? Shout out to Bowen for lending us the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more about Bowen at waypoint.zone/B as in B, boat, O, E, N as in Natalie knows what boats are. I'm going to sign us
out. Title of the episode, right there. There it is. Yep.
I'm gonna take us out on this ship train wreck of a podcast.
Toot, toot.
Toot, toot.
Mom.
Bye. Peace. What do sailors say? Ahoy.
Toot, toot.
What do train people say? Train.
All aboard.
Oh, yeah. All
yes.
aboard.
Train.
Yeah,
train.
Okay. I'm on time. Yeah.
All right.
46?
Sure.
Oh, Patrick.
Patrick.
I missed it.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry. I never like to be that person. I think
AAF caliber, count in, not ready for the NFL.
Don't call me Christian Hackenberg.
All right.
Come on.
Want to do 8?
Yeah.
Sure. All right.
Cool. That was great.
All righty. Can someone give me a count?
Sure.
In 5, 4, 3.
I know what boats are. I know what trains are. I know about modes of transportation.
Yes, you do.
This is just something I do for the fans, for, you know, for the laughs.
The fans have been demanding.
That's why she's America's sweetheart.
I love it like, so much.
Just,
all right.
Just playing the hits.
Now, that's what I call Natalie's jokes. That's a terrible one. Please delete that. That's not going in. Stop recording.
That's our next pod.
Never.
By Natalie Watson. Warehouses full of unsold copies.
It's a delight. It's a true delight.
Oh, drag me. Anyway.
All right.
I'm hungry.
Bye-bye.
Drag me to the boat.
Bye.